This is very much a work in progress. There are lots of parts of this paper that have more questions, and so I fear that this might be more useful for me than it could be for you to be here. But you know, hopefully this will be of some interest. I'm going to be talking mostly about Uganda. I will make references to other places. It's not really intended to be a comparative project, so in a sense the degree of attention that I devote to these different places is quite uneven. And I recognize that as it's currently written, the paper might be unsatisfactory for that reason. But it's not a comparative paper. It's really an exploration of themes, and the big theme I'm interested in here is the relationship between place, legitimacy, and sexuality, and particularly non-heteronormative sexuality. I want to begin with the sorts of things that provoked me to think about the relationship between these three things, which is what I call the politics of essences, or a very particular way of connecting up ideas of place, legitimacy, and sexuality that I think is quite problematic in ways that I will explore. Some of you may know that until July 2009, homosexuality was criminalized in India by the Indian Penal Code, which specifically prohibited carnal intercourse against the order of nature. That's a quote from the provision. Now, central to the constitutional challenge that was lodged against this provision was a kind of discursive battle over what I call the location of homosexuality or homophobia, which is kind of the flip side. Those who supported the continued criminalization of homosexual intercourse insisted that homosexuality was culturally inauthentic, a decadent Western import that had no place in the post-colonial Indian nation state. And those who opposed criminalization pointed to a rich tradition of same-sex love in India and insisted that it was the criminalization of homosexuality that was the import from Victorian Britain into the Indian Penal Code in 1860. So what was interesting was, while adopting diametrically opposed political positions, both positions partook of a kind of a common politics of nativism and indigeneity, in which anything that could not be located within the container of the territorial container of the post-colonial nation state didn't belong there. Now, sometimes, this was the dominant tendency on the part of both conservatives and activists who were fighting them. Sometimes queer activists departed from this script to do something quite different. So one example of this is a letter, an open letter that was put together by a huge number of celebrities from the arts mostly, but also sort of civil society, NGO politics. The lead signatory was the novelist Vikram Seth. And the economist Amartya Sen wrote separately in support. And this letter basically demanded the decriminalization of homosexual sex between consenting adults. It was addressed to the government of India, members of the judiciary, and citizens at large. And it was time to build public pressure in the run-up to one of the hearings of the Delhi High Court. Now, the letter was accompanied by a meticulously researched press kit, which tried to provide an overview of the global position on the criminalization of homosexuality. In some places, the press kit reiterated the position that homosexuality was indigenous and homophobia had been imported, just like most other activist discourse at that time. But other parts of the press kit did something quite different. But towards the very same end, the very same political end of promoting decriminalization. So in particular, on the last page of this press kit, there was a map which sort of graphically represented the global position on criminalization. And the map basically colored countries that continue to criminalize sodomy in orange, and the rest of the world was white. And this effectively meant that most of Africa, the Caribbean, most of the Middle East, South Asia, parts of Southeast Asia were orange, and the rest of the world was white. The colors don't really matter, but you just sort of need to have this in your head. And the map was captioned, only the countries colored in orange continue to criminalize sodomy. To which world must India belong? Now, the question was, I think, entirely rhetorical, relying for its persuasive force on what it knew to be the predispositions of an Indian middle-class, upper-middle-class elite who were desperate to break away from the old third world and take their place at the table of the powerful, the civilized. I'm not sure which category exactly, but You know, there's an overlap between those two things anyway. So, in this map and its accompanying caption, elite Indian activists seemed to be tapping into a deeply held conviction in at least some segments of upper middle class Indian society that progress means becoming like the West. And there's nothing very novel about that conviction. Post-colonial historians like Partho Chatterjee, most famously, have long talked about the Indian middle class's encounter with Western modernity from the colonial period onwards, and he describes that encounter as a split sort of experience of both mimicry and rejection, mimicry in material respects and rejection in what was seen to be spiritual respects. So the East needs to imitate the West insofar as science and technology and statecraft and the economy are concerned, but it risks losing self entirely if it resorts to wholesale mimicry. So it does need to preserve its cultural distinctiveness and its spirituality, and that's sort of how he understands this mimicry and rejection. Now, the mapping of homosexuality onto the West in this activist discourse seems to reflect a hunch on the part of some queer activists about what might be gained through the materialization of sexuality, which has for a very long time been sort of put in the spiritual cultural box rather than being seen as part of material mimicry. And the calculation in that historical, in this historical moment might have been that queer freedoms signal open and tolerant societies, which in turn might be quite profitably used to market India as an increasingly attractive destination for foreign capital. It's a way of signaling openness, and neoliberal Indian elites may have sort of thought that, given that this was the dominant predisposition of Indian elites, it was a useful way of obtaining the sympathies of that elite for the cause of decriminalization. Now, of course, homosexuality is mapped onto the West by other sorts of people in the world as well, often with quite a different sort of politics. And I've talked about this before in some previous work I've done on the activism that Western Western activists have been involved in vis-a-vis the Middle East and Iran. This is a very particular strain of Western activism, so I don't mean to generalize about the activities of Western LGBT organizations at all. But there is this strain in which homosexuality is located at the heart of an enlightened Judeo-Christian West, which sort of faces off against a non-West that is sunk in barbarism and ignorance and superstition. This is good old-fashioned Orientalism in LGBT activism. And I think what's happened is that as LGBT communities have won political and legal rights in Western states and have begun to assimilate more deeply into Western societies, LGBT rights have become a new sort of marker of modernity, a new way of signaling the age-old divide between the civilized and the savage, with states that fail to respect such rights increasingly being characterized as backward, and the internationalization of such rights taking on the character of something like a modern-day civilizing mission. Now, these different discourses that I've alluded to are underpinned by radically different sorts of politics, but what's common to all of them, what the Indian activists are doing to decriminalize homosexuality, what the Western activists are doing in some of their conversations about non-Western about the world, what's common to these otherwise politically quite distinct discourses is what I'm calling a politics of essences, in which homosexuality is located or fixed in particular places. So that particular attitudes towards sexuality come to be marked as defining the essence of what it means to belong to that place. Location in turn is crucial in these discourses to legitimacy, the moral and political acceptability of practices and identities associated with homosexuality. And place, further, is understood in quite absolute terms as designating particular pieces of territory that acquire agency through the instrumentality of the state. Now, I think this practice of locating homosexuality or particular understandings of sexuality in fixed places, understood in these absolute ways, is analytically disingenuous and normatively quite dangerous. It's analytically disingenuous because there is a wealth of anthropological and historical evidence which suggests that homoerotic and homosexual practices have existed across geography and history. But the usefulness of this historical record is complicated by the distinction that is often made between behavior and identity in scholarship on sexuality. So it's now a relatively orthodox claim in sexuality studies that while homosexual behavior has been observed across place and time, the emergence of homosexual identity, which a friend of mine has sort of summarized very pithily as the idea that who I fuck or I'm attracted to says something about the type of person I am. This notion of homosexual identities or sexual desire being an aspect of personhood, of who you are, of saying something, of being an answer to the question, who are you, is a much more recent and culturally specific development. Now, Foucault famously locates this at the end of the 19th century in the West, and he explains it with reference to the operation of discourses of medicine and law. Other scholars have sort of referred to developments in industrial capitalism and mass urbanization as creating the conditions in which traditional family structures are disrupted and providing the conditions for some of anonymity and individual material self-sufficiency, which enable the configuration of new forms of community around non-heteronormative identities. So a whole bunch of things going on in late 19th century Europe that enable the expression of homosexual identities for the first time. And scholars of sexuality in other parts of the world have, in an extension of this thesis, argued that with the diffusion of these enabling conditions to other parts of the world, basically capitalism, urbanization, all of this stuff, you begin to see the expression of these identities in other parts of the world where they haven't been expressed before. To this, some people add HIV/AIDS, which provides a public health frame within which to discuss previously taboo subjects of non-heteronormative sexuality, which also enables the expression of these identities. I have some reservations about this diffusion narrative, both in its cultural guise, Western culture spreading, or in its materialist guise, capitalism spreading, because I think you can see non-heteronormative identities in pre-capitalist, pre-colonial societies as well. But I'm going to leave that reservation to one side for a moment. The reason this behavior identity debate, which I don't think is very controversial anymore, but the reason it's important to what I'm talking about is as follows. I think the location of homosexuality in the West, in the way that I've been talking about before, acquires a whiff of credibility from this idea that homosexual identities originate in Western societies. Yet the unambiguous and unproblematized location of homosexuality in the West ignores the universality of homosexual behavior. It also ignores the relatively recent emergence of homosexual identities even in the West, the very substantial history of Western homophobia, the continuing novelty and fragility of tolerance for sexual difference in many Western societies. Eastern Europe is an example, although whether that's the West is also up for grabs, I think. And the embattled nature of this tolerance and the constantly shifting balance between the forces of tolerance and repression in Western states and societies. In short, these sorts of practices of location pretend that the battle for queer liberation has been won in the West. And by been won, I think, it pretends that it has been completed in the West, and it has been the result entirely of activities, beliefs, practices of Western actors and activists. And this may be a bit of a segue, but into something else. But Leela Gandhi's work on how British activists like Edward Carpenter and E.M. Forster actually use sort of romanticized notions of the Orient as enabling a sexual freedom that doesn't exist in the contemporary West of that time is sort of I think challenges this idea that progressive ideas on this issue came entirely from the West, even in the Western battle. On the other side of the argument, the suggestion by third world queer activists that homosexuality existed in non-Western societies and that homophobia is the Western import trades on the historical evidence of homosexual behavior in non-Western societies. But in doing so, I think it sometimes evinces a tendency to romanticize pre-colonial societies as havens of tolerance for behaviors whose acceptance was in fact often bounded by the requirement that they not interfere with the serious business of heterosexual reproduction. So although homosexual behaviors existed in non-Western societies and were clearly known and perhaps tolerated, that acceptance, I think, my understanding is that it was often conditional on these sorts of behaviors not interfering with what was seen to be the progression of a normal life, which is that people would grow out of these behaviors, they were transitional stages, they were anyone who didn't transition out of them was certainly, in most instances, I think, seen to be abnormal in some way. So I think there is some romanticization going on in activist descriptions of pre-colonial pasts. The location of homosexuality in fixed and bounded places, as if one's attitude towards sexuality was tied up with the essence of what it means to belong to that place, can also be normatively dangerous. I said analytically disingenuous, but this is sort of the more, I guess, the moral side of the problem, which is that it functions as a mechanism of exclusion of all those who don't identify with normative sexualities. I think that's obvious enough. So Western activists who claim tolerance for homosexuality is a Western value effectively leave non-Western queer activists, or queer subjects more generally, vulnerable to the accusation and insinuation of being somehow Western agents or fifth columnists and so forth. And that's very commonly used to discredit any kind of queer activism in places like Iran, for example. Likewise, third world queer activists insisting on the indigenous location of homosexuality, even if for tactical reasons, are often unwittingly reinforcing the very politics of nativism that is often used to oppress them. This is the idea that only that which can be located within the territory has place and legitimacy in the post-colonial nation state. So if we abandon this politics of essences, what are the ways there to talk about, to understand the institutionalization of homophobia in particular places and times? How can we talk about this issue differently? And I've been influenced here by David Harvey's ideas in Cosmopolitanism and the Geographies of Freedom, where he urges that we move away from an Aristotelian conception of the world as composed of distinct and autonomous things, each with its own essence, to more dialectical and process-oriented philosophies, which hold that things have no unchanging essence and do not exist outside the processes, flows, and relations that create, sustain, or undermine them. So he's very critical of the rigid ways in which geographical concepts such as space, place, and environment are deployed by non-geographers in the social sciences. And he tries to lay out this more complex apparatus to think about other dimensions of space and time. For example, in the chapter on space, he contrasts absolute, relative, and relational time. But I think one of his key claims, and this is the one I want to pick up on, is that moving from these Aristotelian essentialist ways of thinking about identity to the more dialectical and process-based philosophies that he prefers could have important liberatory potentials, and that's what I want to explore. Harvey notes that one of the key repressive characteristics of governmentality and its associated political economy has been to confine our understanding of space and time to its absolute dimensions. This is also quite visible in the work of James Scott, Seeing Like a State, when he talks about how the clear and unambiguous location, definition, and classification of people and things in absolute space and time has been most conducive to serving state and capitalist interests in the appropriation of resources and the political control and manipulation of subjects. Conversely, those subjects have tended to feel less alone and more capable of resisting their subjection, precisely when they've been able to think and act outside of the absolute dimensions of space and time, by drawing on the potentialities of relative space-time, opened up by advances in transport and communication, and by constructing relational solidarities across borders. So Harvey is saying we need to think in relative and relational space-time, because that might help liberate oppressed subjects from the absolutist conceptions of space and time in which they're trapped, by the boundaries of nation states, by the operation of capital, and so forth. But I think rather than simply privileging relative and relational space-time, he's urging that we think about these things in dialectical relation to one another. How do these different dimensions interact, rather than simply urging a sort of neat epistemic reversal, replace one with the other? Okay, so we've seen, or I've tried to sort of talk a little bit about how the location of homosexuality in absolute space and time is analytically problematic and normatively dangerous. So I'm trying to think now about how we might bring Harvey's preferred dialectical and process-oriented epistemologies to think about this problem of understanding how and when and why homophobia becomes institutionalized in particular places and times. So in this next section, I just want to think a bit about queer scholarship that is trying to think about homophobia in not in these essentialized ways, but in more genealogical terms, in these more process-oriented terms, flows, those kinds of ideas, rather than fixing them in time and place. And there are increasingly more and more instances of this. For example, a lot of queer scholarship now locates the institutionalization of homophobia moment, if you can call it that, in the sort of discursive encounter between colonial and indigenous elites. So Mark Eprecht, for example, looking at politicized homophobia in Zimbabwe, talks about how it has roots in both traditional African culture, but is also enormously indebted to Christian missionary propaganda, Western pseudoscience, and what he calls the demonstration effect of white Rhodesian cowboy culture. There's some scholarship in India that does the same thing. Ruth Vanita and Salim Kidwai talking about same-sex love in Indian literary and historical texts. Note an amplification of homophobia in colonial India under the influence of Western discourses of law, medicine, and literature. I think broadly what these writers are doing is they're arguing that in the colonial encounter you begin to see in nationalist discourse a kind of erasure of ideas of androgyneity, much more fluid notions of gender. Things become much more hardened in this colonial moment because of this perception that anti-colonial nationalists need to construct a virile, masculinized nationalism that can effectively combat imperialist oppression. Interestingly enough, a recent Human Rights Watch report on Iraq says something remarkably similar about why we're beginning to see Shia, well, it mostly talks about Shia death squads, and the attacks that they're launching against men who are perceived to be gay and effeminate. And the argument there is that 7 years of occupation have sort of engendered a crisis in Iraqi masculinity that these death squads are trying to recuperate in some way by ridding their culture of all elements of weakness that they think have sold out or are somehow representative of the occupying culture. But the clearest narrative that I've come across about that thinks through this in these discursive terms is scholarship on Iran, and I've used this a little bit in some previous work, but I'll just briefly allude to that before moving on to Uganda. And this is talking about how homophobia is institutionalized in the colonial encounter in the late 19th century. Afsane Najmabadi is quite illuminating here. There's a lot of work on Iran on gender in Iran, Janet Afari particularly, which talks about the wealth of allusions to homoerotic relations in Persian language and literature, lots of textual evidence of the prevalence of homosexuality and homoerotic expression in public spaces in Iran before this 19th century moment. And while not free of moral judgments, the argument that both Afari and Najmabadi make is that Iranian representations of same-sex love become much more judgmental towards the end of the 19th century. Afsane Najmabadi argues that as Iranian elites came into contact with Europeans and realized that polite European society considered homosexuality to be abominable, their response was one of disavowal and dissimulation. So Iranians began to find themselves explaining to European visitors that the Europeans had mistakenly read homosociality, the mere fact of men holding hands or embracing in public spaces, as homosexuality. They began to be very embarrassed about homoeroticism in Sufi poetry, which now began to be explained away as purely metaphorical and allegorical for the love that the devout has for the divine, and not meant to be understood in literal terms at all. Practices of representation undergo dramatic shifts in this period. So in notions of beauty are quite undifferentiated in early Qajar paintings, with beautiful men and women being depicted with quite similar facial and bodily features. But by the time you get to this period, suddenly portrayals of beauty become much less androgynous and much more gendered. Similarly, biographical writing, she argues, which contain numerous non-judgmental references to diverse sexual preferences before this 19th century moment, become much more disapproving in the 20th century. And perhaps most interestingly, modernist Iranian intellectuals in this period begin to speak of homosexuality as situational, as something that Iranian men did in the past because they didn't have access to women, because of the gender segregation of that society. And so by implication, these modernist Iranian intellectuals argue, as the sexes are allowed to mingle freely in a modernizing Iran, homosexual relations would disappear. One of the central projects of early Iranian feminism in this same moment is the transformation of heterosexual marriage from a loveless procreative contract to a romantic one. But part of that project involves delegitimizing other forms of love. or sex, or sexual intimacy of any kind. So Najmabadi argues that the beginning of women's emancipation in Iran carries this a sort of birthmark of the disavowal of male homosexuality, which is a really interesting idea. Male homosexuality as the enemy of Iranian feminism, rather than the sort of alliance of the excluded that I think we tend to assume in many other contexts. So the larger point here is that the heteronormalization of Iranian society comes to be seen as a mark of modernity in the late 19th century as a result of this encounter with a European modernity that's perceived to be more advanced and civilized and developed. There is an irony here, because if heteronormalization is the mark of modernity in the late 19th century, today, in the early 21st century, Iran is considered backward because it executes homosexuals. But that's, you know, that's a separate issue. But what interests me about Najmabadi's way of thinking about the institutionalization of homophobia in the late 19th century is that it acknowledges pre-colonial homosexual behavior without valorizing pre-colonial histories as uniquely tolerant. It recognizes the power of example and instruction and imposition wielded by the colonial powers, but it also recognizes the agency of Iranian elites in choosing to confront the colonial challenge, in part through strategies of mimicry, which are deployed to construct this virile masculinized nationalism. So Iranian elites are making choices about how to respond to European modernity. This isn't an idea of sexuality that's necessarily forced on them. This is a project of resistance through mimicry, as well as rejection, but in this case more mimicry than rejection. So these dialectical genealogies of homophobia seem intuitively attractive because they allow for the mixedness of all places, the universality of both homophobia and tolerance of non-heteronormative desire. But they can also explain the institutionalization of homophobia at particular junctures with reference to elite ideas about the relationship between sexuality and civilizational progress, and to the ways in which those ideas are challenged and reshaped in interaction with external actors. So what I'm going to do in this last section, how much time do we have?
Half an hour.
Okay. So, well, not the last, the last section is quite long. This is where I talk about Uganda. I want to think through this sort of dialectical, process-oriented, the flows way of thinking about the institutionalization of homophobia in the context of an ongoing controversy in present-day Uganda. And what interests me about Uganda, besides the political stakes of what's involved, which are actually quite high, but what interests me here is that the encounters are ongoing, and so scholars can, you can actually talk to the people involved in these encounters and ask them where their ideas of sexuality are coming from and why they think what they think in a way that is more difficult to do, in a sort of, I don't know, you're an audience of historians, so perhaps you don't think of it in this way, but I suppose Uganda is more difficult in some ways than Iran because it's not as textual a culture as Iran is, so the issue of records and of how one thinks about these issues is a lot more difficult. The only texts are missionary sources, which record things in a very particular way, of course. But, you know, I think when I explain this, it'll become clearer. But I guess my point is, it is still possible to talk about, to talk to the different actors involved in this contemporary moment of institutionalization of homophobia in a way that you can't do, for obvious reasons, with the Iranian case. So, okay, just a bit of background on what's happening in Uganda. On the 13th of October in 2009, a self-described anti-homosexuality bill was introduced in the Ugandan parliament, which proposes to enhance punishments. Homosexuality is already penalized by the Ugandan penal code, but this bill will enhance some of those punishments, including introducing the death penalty for some kinds of offenses. Having sex with a minor, having sex if you're HIV positive, or committing any of the other offenses in the bill more than three times. Are the circumstances in which the death penalty would be imposed. The bill also does some other things. It asserts extraterritorial jurisdiction over these offenses, which means that Ugandans anywhere in the world committing these offenses would fall within the ambit of the bill. And it criminalizes any form of organization in support of rights for homosexuals, so all advocacy, activism of any kind, and the provision is framed quite broadly, so it would catch quite a lot. It also makes it a requirement to report on anyone who has knowledge of homosexual conduct, whether it be a friend, a parent, a doctor, a lawyer, is obliged to report such conduct, failing which they will also be vulnerable to prosecution. I think there's a prison sentence, so I'm not sure how long. The text of the bill is available, but that's just a brief overview of what it's trying to do. The bill is informed by the familiar view of homosexuality as Western, un-African, and un-Ugandan. And it clarifies its aims as, amongst other things, and this is a quote from the bill, providing a comprehensive and enhanced legislation to protect the cherished culture of the people of Uganda, legal, religious, and traditional family values of the people of Uganda, against the attempts of sexual rights activists seeking to impose their values of sexual promiscuity on the people of Uganda. Now, in response to this, sexual rights activists in Uganda have been trying to construct genealogies of homophobia that highlight the implication of external and specifically Western actors in the production of homophobia in Uganda. So this is again a tried and tested activist technique. The conservatives say homosexuality is Western, we will say homophobia is Western, and we will talk about the involvement of Western actors in the institutionalization of homophobia in Uganda in order to delegitimize our opponents. So my ongoing, and really I've only done a 2-week sort of field trip to Uganda in which I've interviewed activists, so the work really is ongoing, and this is where I have more questions than answers, but it's trying to understand the complexities of constructing these genealogies of homophobia. If you want to construct a narrative that relies on this idea of flows and processes, you know, how would you do it, or how are activists doing it in this moment? They're focusing on two kinds of encounters with the West. One is a contemporary encounter between Ugandan politicians and clergy and American conservative Christians, evangelical Christians from different denominations. So that's one encounter that they're focusing on. But another really interesting and I think relevant encounter to this story is something that takes place in the late 19th century, to which much less reference is being made by activists. I'll talk about that in a moment. But first, to say something about the close relationships between Ugandan politicians and clergy on the one hand and Western, mostly US conservative evangelical Christians on the other. So recently, a number of scholars and activists have begun to draw attention to the efforts of US Christian conservatives to recruit prominent African religious leaders to a global campaign seeking to restrict the rights of queer subjects. It's been suggested that it is no coincidence that the Ugandan bill was introduced in the same year that US anti-gay activists, and they call themselves that, Scott Lively, Don Schmierer, there are others names that elude me at the moment, but Scott Lively and Don Schmierer are the two who are mentioned quite a lot. In the same year that the Ugandan bill is introduced, they held a prominent, what they called a seminar on exposing the homosexual agenda in Kampala, which received a lot of attention from local politicians, clergy, and the media. Basically, the relationship between the Americans and the African clergy, and mostly what I'm going to talk about now, is understood in the following way, which is that as Western churches, and I think for a moment I'll focus on the Anglican Communion and the Anglican Church in the US, which is what I know a bit more about, but as the Episcopalian Church in the U.S. drifts in ever more liberal directions on social issues like abortion and homosexuality and the ordination of women as priests and so forth, and these tend to be the wedge issues in that church, conservatives are increasingly beginning to feel like they're on the back foot. In previous instances of such crisis, they have tended to split from the church and to set up their own churches. But they don't seem to want to do that, in part because of what they would lose. And I think property is a big issue that keeps them within the church and I think induces this desire to not cede the ground to liberals, but rather to win the battle on that terrain instead of setting up a new denomination or church. So instead of leaving the church, they're trying to forge these alliances with other branches of the global membership that are also seen to be socially conservative, in the hope that they can wield a kind of demographic majority against the liberals in global norm-setting fora, such as the decennial Lambeth Conference that the Anglican Communion has every 10 years. Additionally, within the Anglican Communion, and again, I think this has happened quite a lot in the US and, well, more in the US and to some extent in the UK, there have been of late a number of controversial moves in which parishes who are unhappy with the increasingly liberal trends within their dioceses have seceded, in a way, from those dioceses. They have refused the spiritual oversight of liberal bishops in their respective dioceses and placed themselves under what they call the temporary spiritual oversight of primates and bishops in other provinces of the Anglican Communion. So you have churches in places like Tennessee that have split from their liberal dioceses and have placed themselves under the temporary spiritual oversight of the primate of Rwanda or Kenya or Uganda or Nigeria. And those are the most frequent, these are the countries that are most frequently drawn into these relationships. So in return for the demographic support that the African clergy give them in these global norm-setting fora, the Americans argue that they are receiving spiritual protection from the liberal onslaught of the liberals in the Episcopalian Church. And the conservative Anglicans in the U.S. have in turn rewarded the African churches financially. Kapia Kaoma, who's a Zambian priest currently based in Boston, recently wrote a report that outlines many of these trends and relationships, and he suggests that African priests and congregations for whom homosexuality was not a significant issue before the mid-1990s have essentially been co-opted into the U.S. culture wars through the lure of conservative money, which has tended to be offered with fewer strings and less demands for accountability than liberal Christian money, which is still dispensed through the official structures of the Anglican Communion. Now, this is a really, actually the book that has helped me think through this stuff most effectively is Miranda Hassett's The Anglican Communion in Crisis, I think is what it's called. And it's a wonderful book because these relationships between conservative American evangelicals and African priests sort of defy, at least I come out of international relations and we have this very stereotyped view of American exceptionalism. We think of this as the dominant ideological trend in contemporary American politics, particularly when it comes to foreign relations and foreign affairs, which is this idea that America sets the standard for the rest of the world and doesn't need to abide by international law. Miranda Hassett's work on these relationships, and she talks to members of dioceses on both sides of this relationship, in both Ugandan churches and American churches. And she says these are deeply conservative, white, southern, Republican-voting Americans who think that America has a problem. America requires intervention, and the intervention will come from Africa, because Africa is Africans practice a version of Christianity that is seen to be more zealous, somehow closer to what Christianity should be about, less corrupted by modernity. There are all sorts of ideas about the noble savage sort of wrapped up in this kind of discourse. But it's a very unusual way of thinking about America's relationships with the world, and it comes from people that you least expect it, because these aren't liberal internationalists. Anyway, so liberal accounts of these relationships have tended to describe them in terms of an exchange in which the material wealth of U.S. partners is exchanged for the spiritual wealth of African churches. So the transaction is made to look quite instrumental. Conservatives in the U.S. have responded to this characterization by accusing the liberals of racism and condescension. And they've said that the insinuation that African churches would say whatever they were told to simply in exchange for a wad of cash smacks of racist condescension in the insinuation that African clergy are ready to sell their souls to the highest bidder. So paradoxically, you have the conservatives accusing the liberals here of racism, of not being liberal internationalists, in a sense. But what's striking, I think, about the liberal account is the way in which American evangelicals are portrayed as the drivers and authors of homophobia in Uganda, with the Ugandan actors functioning merely as an instrument of their will. So you have this really paradoxical situation in which in Uganda, the conservatives argue that homosexuality is imported from the West, And the Ugandan activists and the Western liberals argue that homophobia is imported from the West. And somehow the agency of the African actors has completely disappeared. Everything here is about what Western actors are doing, with Uganda just functioning as a kind of arena in which a Western fight is taking place. So one of the things I've been trying to do is to try and understand what the agency of African actors is in this. What are they actually doing? And this is what I've been trying to get at in my interviews, which have so far mostly been with Ugandan sexual minority activists. And so I've been asking questions like, when did homosexuality begin to become an important issue for African churches? How do we explain the timing of this? Would the bill have been introduced without the influence of the American evangelicals? And most people have said yes. Most of the activists I've been interviewed have said yes. And if so, what is the nature and role and importance of the Americans in this development? One of the issues that worries me about the questions I'm asking is that reintroducing the agency of African clergy and politicians in the enhanced criminalization of homosexuality could deprive activists of one of the ideas that they've deployed to suggest that homophobia is foreign and therefore ought to be rejected. In effect, by trying to put back African agency into the story, if that were done, Ugandan activists would no longer be able to say homophobia is culturally inauthentic because it came from outside. So there's a tension here between, you know, the kinds of truths that activists are trying to produce and the kinds of truths that academics are trying to produce, and that troubles me. I think the native foreign discourse is tactically very useful, but it's also politically quite conservative in a strategic, sort of more long-term sense, I think. Now, interestingly, many of my interviews, virtually all of whom have been black Ugandans, seemed to agree strongly with the white liberal critique with the liberal critique, more broadly, that African clergy have sold out to conservative money. Unburdened by historic white liberal guilt, black Ugandans seem ready and able to say that African pastors were in fact financially minded enough to indulge in homophobic rhetoric in the expectation of conservative Western financial assistance. And a lot of my interviewees have pointed out that if you want to make money in Uganda, starting a church is the best and easiest way to do it, because the churches in Uganda are not taxed, they are barely regulated in other respects. And, you know, this is one of the most lucrative opportunities in Uganda, sort of ranking right up there with working for the government or setting up an NGO, actually, figured quite a lot. So, you know, the activists seem to have no qualms about saying this is entirely about money, this is an instrumental transaction. Some of them said, well, the money is used for progressive purposes, so it could be that African priests are appearing to buy into the rhetoric, but are then using the money for quite progressive goals. This seems hard to sustain, because in order to keep the flow going, they would have to continue to produce the kind of homophobic rhetoric that begins the flow of money in the first place. So I'm not sure how convincing that response is. But I think theoretically, these difficulties with delineating agency in collaborative relationships points to broader theoretical difficulties and, as I said earlier, hints at tensions between the analytical and the normative, between the preoccupations of the academic and the activist. Somehow it doesn't seem to be enough to say that homophobia in contemporary Uganda is a hybrid formation. We know that hybridity can conceal hierarchical relationships, and we then want to know which partners in these relationships have what sorts of agency. But in attempting to delineate agency in this fashion, I think the temptation is to sort of split the hybrid formation into its constituent parts and to endow each of these parts with an essence. The homophobic Americans meet the instrumental or the easily deluded Africans. So that somehow in discussing the politics of encounter and flows and, you know, this dialectical stuff, we've almost come back to the politics of essences. At least that seems to me to be the activist temptation. It's very hard to do activism in this context without doing that. It seems difficult to talk about hybridity beyond, you know, in a specific way without doing that. Because you can describe something as a hybrid cultural formation in retrospect, but in the moment of its production, you do want to sort of split it up and think about what's coming from where. And that sort of returns us to a much more essentialist description of the process. How much more time? Yeah. The second encounter that I wanted to talk about is one that takes place in the late 19th century. And this is, for me at least, not being a historian, this is harder to get at, but it's really fascinating, I think. In his illuminating account of the genealogy of homophobia in southern Africa, Neville Hoad recounts the fate of the last pre-colonial native ruler of the Kingdom of Buganda, which is now the central region of present-day Uganda. Missionary sources of the time make reference somewhat coyly to Kabaka Mwanga. Kabaka, the institution of the Kabaka, was the ruler of Buganda. And Mwanga is the name of the last pre-colonial Kabaka. So Kabaka Mwanga, missionary sources make reference to his unnatural desires, which he was accustomed to consummating with pages in his court. When, after their conversion to Christianity, some of these pages refused his advances, Mwanga had them burnt to death, setting off a chain of events that culminate in the awarding of a royal charter in to the British East African Company, which is then in charge of preserving law and order in Buganda. So ironically, this instance of, you know, what people think was sodomy in the court is sort of central to the institution of colonial rule, in this reading at least. Now, Neville Hoad is careful not to use this incident to call Mwanga a homosexual or to suggest that homosexuality is African, because this runs into the theoretical problem of imposing identitarian politics in a place and time where it just was meaningless. So, but he cautions that the missionaries may have recorded and recoded as unnatural vice a set of older practices that might have served some other purpose. These favors that the king, the Kabaka, demanded of men in his court may have been ritual, religious, initiatory, or fealty-producing functions, he speculates. Far from being reducible to idiosyncratic depravities, he suggests that the corporeal intimacies, so he's very careful here, he's not even saying sex, he's saying corporeal intimacies that could have been about much more than sexual desire. That Mwanga demanded of his courtiers may have served as a test of political loyalty in a time of eroding authority. Just as Mwanga's demands on his pages were political, or perhaps in part political, resistance to those demands may also have been political, so that physical intimacies may have stood for much more than they might appear to contemporary readers steeped in an identitarian view of sexuality. So from the point of view of the participants in these events, it may have been the case that chastity marked loyalty to Christianity and the white missionaries, while sodomy marked an allegiance to the Kabaka and the Buganda state. But while resisting a modern sexual identitarian reading of these events, Hoad nonetheless uses them to remind readers that the corporeal intimacies that are claimed by African elites to be the result of Western cultural imperialism were the very practices that were stamped out by an earlier wave of European imperialism. It seems to me that Hoad wants to sort of have his cake and eat it too, because he's resisting the sexual identitarian reading of this incident. But at the same time, he's saying these practices, he's saying in a way these behaviors existed, so African elites today can't claim that they are alien to African culture, even if the identities are. Now, this story has been a big focus of my interview so far. Before I went to Uganda, I expected that it would be used a lot by the activists. I thought that they'd use it quite a lot to talk about, in the same way that Hoad is insinuating, to sort of suggest that homosexual behavior was prevalent. Very few people in Uganda deny this story, so it's not contested insofar as, you know, Mwanga is believed to have sex with men in his court, and very few people contest that. But the story hasn't been used very much at all, apart from a few stray references in articles by a woman called Sylvia Tamale, who is Dean of the Law Faculty in Makerere University, and Andrew Mwenda, who is a journalist, an independent journalist in Kampala. So a lot of my questioning has been focused on why activists aren't using this story. First, in line with one of Hoad's readings of the story, the events of the 1880s are not read primarily as a tale about sexual morality. Rather, it's remembered as an account of conflict between church and state, between the natural divine law and positive human law, and the primacy of the former over the latter. So to use this story in the argument about indigenous attitudes towards sexuality would be to play up what is a very minor dimension of the story. It's not remembered primarily for the sex, it's remembered for what it illustrates about the conflict between natural positive, natural and positive law. But secondly, using another reason why this story might be difficult to use from the point of view of sexual minority activists is that it would require a reversal of the positive and negative codings of the actors in it. Because it's the pages who were burnt to death for their political disloyalty and religious faith who've been celebrated as the heroes of this story in post-colonial Ugandan history. They were canonized by the Catholic Church. They are commemorated in a shrine at Namugongo, which is a few kilometers outside of Kampala. And they're remembered every year on the 3rd of June, which is celebrated as Martyrs' Day. So given the power of this hegemonic narrative, it seems to me that it might be an uphill task to now hold Mwanga's behavior up as setting a normative standard of sexuality, even if only to counter the ahistorical and inaccurate claim made by contemporary conservatives in Uganda that such sexualities are un-African and un-Ugandan. And in fact, you'd have to rehabilitate Mwanga, and then you'd have to hold him up as a normative standard. And that, I think, is a very difficult task. But it does raise some questions which I hope to investigate further, which is, when did the currently hegemonic reading of the events of the late 1880s become predominant, and how did it attain this status? Was the story read differently in the moment in which it took place? And has the way in which the story is told changed over time, and if so, how? More particularly, do non-hegemonic readings of these events that celebrate Mwanga as the heroic figure standing up to British imperialism and an alien religion, do such non-hegemonic readings exist? One of my interviewees said, yes, they do exist. He said, in parts in our history textbooks, we do celebrate Mwanga as the anti-colonial hero of that story. So that to me was really interesting. I said, but then you celebrate both Mwanga and the Ugandan martyrs, who are on opposite sides in this battle. How can you celebrate both? And without batting an eyelid, he said, well, the history part of our book celebrates Mwanga, and the religion and ethics part of our book celebrates the pages. So what I want to do in the next part of my research, I think, is to get hold of not tertiary education, but sort of secondary school history textbooks, and look at how this story is told and taught in schools, and how it's remembered in a popular sort of way. And if it's really the case that both sides of that transaction, of that dispute, are celebrated, I think that's really peculiar. So how is that sustained in Ugandan popular culture and memory? So I guess this is a question about historical memory and how it's playing out in contemporary Ugandan politics. But a third reason the story is not used, and I'll sort of end here, is that, and this is more tactical and has to do with contemporary Ugandan politics, some of my interviews caution that the suggestion that Mwanga engaged in same-sex intimacies, however carefully you phrase this, risks alienating the Baganda people today, who, as the largest tribe in contemporary Ugandan society, wield enormous political and social power. And Ugandans are very alert to the power of the Baganda, because there were riots on an unrelated issue in September 2009, which kind of demonstrated that they were still a live force, and the Kabaka is still a live institution in contemporary Ugandan politics, even though he doesn't have, you know, elected office. And in their view, any move that alienates the Baganda people risks certain political defeat. Other activists have said, We must tell this story, even if the Baganda might get pissed off. And still others have said, it matters who tells this story. So if somebody from within the community, who's already respected within the Baganda people, offers this revisionist reading, that might fly much better than, you know, somebody from outside or from another tribe in Uganda. So just to wrap up, I've been trying to operationalize Harvey's dialectical, process-oriented way of thinking about the institutionalization of homophobia. I'm trying to apply it to my interest in thinking about the institutionalization of homophobia, but I've come up against all these problems. And the one I would sort of pick out is the problem with thinking about hybridity and the sort of move back to essentialism. In order to give hybridity any specificity, we seem to sort of go back to essentialism, and that troubles me. Because in post-colonial theory, you know, people like Homi Bhabha, the idea of hybridity was championed in the first place because it was seen to be both an analytically more specific way of talking about the colonial encounter, but also a normatively preferable way of thinking about identity, because it doesn't sort of police the boundaries of identity and community in the way that essentialist politics does.